Welcome to Private Equity Perspectives, a podcast by BDO USA's private equity practice. Each episode, BDO connects with leaders in the private equity space to discuss the latest trends driving deal activity, fund strategies, and portfolio company optimization.
Hello, and welcome back to BDO's Private Equity Perspectives podcast, where we explore the trends impacting private equity today. I'm Todd Kinney, National Relationship Director in BDO's Private Equity Practice. Today, we are once again joined by Nicholas Vega Yona, Principal at Lincolnshire, and Monty York, Managing Partner at Gen X 360. If this is your first time hearing from Nico and Monty, I'd recommend going back to part A of my conversation with them, which was released a couple of weeks ago, to hear us discuss the biggest shifts in private equity in 2025 and how their portcos perform relative to expectation. Now, this episode will take a closer look at deal flow expectations, valuation outlooks, exit strategies, creative deal structures, and where smart money will focus in 2026. Just a quick reminder to our listeners that the remarks and opinions of our guests do not necessarily represent BDO's views. So Nico kicked us off for part A of the episode. So Monty, I'm going to have you start us off for part B. When you look into 2026, do you expect deal flow to meaningfully pick up, or do you think we're in a slower, more disciplined cycle for a while?
Hey, Todd, Nico, great to get back together here. So, you know, it's interesting. You know, we started off 2025 expecting it to be a great kickoff. 2026 is around the corner. And I think people are hopeful that 2026 is going to pick up. The feedback I'm getting from a lot of our investment bank relationships is that they're certainly pitching more opportunities than they've ever had. And the backlog is quite robust. But I'm going to be careful and not set myself up for disappointment with another year that's not as robust as expected. I do feel like some of the challenges associated with 2025 are slowly starting to move away from us, such as interest rates coming down. And also, I think people getting a better appreciation, or at least a better ability to deal with tariff and policy uncertainties. So I feel like 2026 will end up being more robust than 2025. For us, I think the key really is we'll stick to our knitting. We're going to focus on what we do well, and that's frankly our proactive sourcing process. It's worked very well in terms of getting really smart on sectors that we're interested in that have the characteristics we're looking for, and then going and finding those right opportunities. Sometimes they come up on a proprietary basis and sometimes through auction situations, but the model's worked well for us. I think we're going to stick to our knitting, and hopefully what we'll see is a market that opens up more from a purchasing perspective and also from an exit perspective. We've got several assets that are performing well and hopeful that the markets are going to be receptive to those.
All right. Well, it makes sense to me, Monty. From my BDO Capital bankers to other banker friends in the middle market, as you said, people have been pitching a lot and there's a nice backlog of deals expected to come to market in early to mid-January. So we'll keep our fingers crossed. But Nico, over to you there. I know you've been waiting patiently. What are your thoughts? Do you expect deal flow to meaningfully pick up in 2026, or are we settling in for a more disciplined cycle?
Hey, Todd, thanks for having me back, Monty. Great catching up with you again. So I'll reflect something that Monty alluded to. I think that everything we are hearing from our M&A advisors would suggest a pickup in pipeline. So we've been hearing that story for a while. So again, I don't want to set myself up, as Monty didn't want to, overconfide in the market becoming a lot more robust. Now, I will say that if the lack of sponsor exits in recent years is any indication, there should be more companies coming to market in 2026. I think it's also important to remember, as Monty also alluded to, that you know the Fed's fund rate went from, what, 5.5 at its peak in Q2, Q3 of 2024, down to 3.75 as of October, and maybe 3.5 by the end of this year. This allows folks to ultimately pay more for a business and marginally more for a business and get similar returns, because the dollars that would have gone to interest rate payments can now go to pay down debt or even deploy on growth initiatives. That's just, you know, the basic LBO math. So that, in combination with dry powder sitting on the sidelines, I think could potentially drive another high multiple year, even with more opportunities coming to market, is if that is ultimately the case, which is obviously challenging for funds looking to remain price disciplined. So there is something to be said for focusing on the portfolio and looking to accelerate growth in the well-performing companies that still have significant white space, essentially deploying further capital into growth initiatives in those companies that we already own. Now, it could also be the case that I think it's the case that we're all hopeful for, that the pipeline does pick up enough that there are less buyers for each interesting opportunity on average. This generally sounds more attractive, but could be challenging for funds looking at 2026 as a year to generate DPI from exits. That's its own type of discipline in the sense that you could have to weigh generating DPI now versus potentially leaving upside dollars on the table. Look, ultimately, we will all have to play the cards that we are dealt next year. I am certain that we will find deals in 2026 like we did in 2025. But if the auction pipeline remains tight and the interest rates continue to lower, further fueling higher multiples, I think investment discipline will come down to the GP, and what we will do there is lean more on our direct sourcing model.
All right, appreciate that perspective. I'll just say the three of us are cautiously optimistic and we'll move on. So let's switch over and now take it from deal flow expectations to valuation. Nico, you're going to take this first one if you don't mind. What's your current outlook on valuations? Do you expect them to reset lower, stabilize where they are now, or climb again as capital comes off the sidelines?
Yeah, the magic eight ball question. I think we've already touched upon a few drivers that affect valuations, including the total dry powder in the market, interest rates continuing to lower, and of course, the potential normalization of trade relationships that would result in better visibility and allow procurement management to be more carefully thought out. In the private markets, though, namely for PE platforms going through robust auction processes, there are two particular drivers for valuations. One is the quality of the business itself, and the other, the number of available quality businesses. Then, of course, on top of that, you have some of those other exogenous variables like higher or lower interest rate environment, looser or tighter labor markets, and an adverse or friendlier trade backdrop. Going back, though, to just private equity platforms in robust auction processes, there's two big questions that I think you have to ask. One is, how good is this business? So, does it have real barriers to entry? Does it have a growth trajectory that is sustainable? Does it have a robust margin profile, a significant wallet share in a growing space? And most importantly, does it have a quality management team? If the answer is yes, then that business will be robustly priced. Then, two, how many of these are available? If the answer is that there's only a few available, then that same business will potentially command a synthetically higher multiple just due to scarcity. So, as a firm, I don't think that we have a blanket opinion on what's going to happen to valuations in 2026. However, I do think that how valuations move will differ greatly by the outlook in each company's respective market, as well as specifically to each company, what their market positioning is and how attainable the next phase of growth is. And that, of course, includes how much that next phase of growth will cost from a follow-on dollar standpoint. So, all this just gets back to the quality of the asset and how many buyers are interested in that space and that particular asset. Let's remember that in aggregate, private equity is usually a trend following exercise, and that in the past, that has led to multiples in certain attractive spaces ballooning. And then finally, I'll just mention that 401k now has private equity as an investable asset class. There will be more money coming into this market. So multiples and valuations could further be driven up by that.
Yeah. All right. Lots of good points there, Nico. So, Monty, not necessarily do I ask you want to agree or disagree with Nico, but what's your outlook on valuations heading into 2026?
Well, I think Nico did a great job of kind of laying out all the factors involved
Yep.
in influencing valuations. The only point I would really add is how an organization operates in an environment of this uncertainty. And frankly, we as an organization, we pick our spots, sectors that we know well, that we have conviction in. We'll pay the premium for the right assets where we believe we can have significant impact in enhancing those businesses, driving improved revenue margins, executing on that buy and build strategy to drive synergies, and creating, once again, world-class businesses. So I think we have to recognize that, you need to be able to operate in any environment,
Yeah.
have disciplines, but ultimately focus on where you can have the greatest impact and value creation.
Fair enough. Let's turn our attention to exits and deal structures. Given how tough the exit environment was in 2025, with firms balancing LP pressure against protecting IRRs, how do you expect PE to approach exits differently in 2026? And separately, how do you see more creative deal structures, including the rise of secondaries, shaping deal making next year? Monty, can you kick us off on this one?
Yeah, sure. There's obviously lots of pressure from existing investors who are seeking return of capital. Although, having said that, they are seeking return of capital at attractive returns. So the art is in finding the balance between the two. You know, with the right assets, as Nico mentioned, you know, you're going to continue to attract attention and get attractive valuations, even in a difficult environment. So the key is creating the great assets. But I do feel that there are some other more creative alternatives that are becoming more and more prevalent. One of those is ultimately the secondary market, selling into the secondary market, ultimately maybe through a continuation fund. That is a market that I think is becoming more acceptable to our investors. I think key to that is recognizing that it's becoming a more competitive and more efficient market. So valuations are getting to valuations that are oftentimes quite comparable to what you would find in a full exit process. And there's a lot of capital that's in the secondary market that is engaged in seeking to put money to work. We have been able to use that in very select situations where we have very strong portfolio companies where we are seeking incremental capital, really additional equity to support an aggressive buy and build and growth strategy. And in those circumstances, we're able to derive very attractive returns to our investors, 3 times in one case, 4.6 times in another, while providing us the opportunity to work further with a management team in an industry and with a company that we know well. So I believe that's going to prove out to be an even better opportunity for the right asset to continue to drive return of capital for the investors, and at the same time, providing the opportunity to work with an existing asset that we know well.
Right. Lots of good insight there, Lonnie. Thanks. Nico, what are your thoughts?
I'll echo something Monty alluded to. I think those Class A assets will trade for a robust price no matter how busy the pipeline gets. We at LincolnShire have a couple of assets we consider A assets that we'd like to take to market over the next 12 months. I think that strategic investors, having become more active in M&A, will also help those exits, as they are usually willing to pay premiums given potential synergies directly associated with their businesses. That, of course, is helpful to sponsors like ourselves as we look to maximize distributions in the coming years. So the reason we are so focused on that is I think that feedback from investors is clear. LPs are now very focused on DPI rather than on paper value, which seemed to be the trend a few years ago. This creates an interesting dynamic where a platform that has a lot more upside could go into a continuation vehicle, generating distribution for existing LPs and allowing those who want the additional upside to stick around. As a firm, our thoughts on these GP-led secondaries are fairly straightforward. As long as there is a fair and appropriate treatment of existing LPs, we are open to continuation vehicles as a DPI generator for current investors and an upside engine for new capital that wishes to partner with LincolnShire for the long term. I think it's definitely something interesting and something to keep an eye on.
All right, Nico, appreciate your take and really valuable info from both of you. So believe it or not, our final question of the episode here is I'm going to ask you both to consult your crystal ball. So let's discuss where we think the opportunities are going to sit next year, say where the smart money will focus, which specific sectors, strategies, or themes will take center stage for PE. Nico, why don't we come back to you for this one?
So on sectors and trends, there's a few we're keeping a close eye on through the end of the year, of this year and sort of into the next. I think that the data center rollout and operating exposure remains highly attractive. So putting aside the valuations of the companies driving a lot of the digital infrastructure growth, the commitments to the build out and the demand for the operation of those data centers is real. So services or components for those data centers, I think, should remain an area of focus. A trend we really like is the wellness trend. So we're seeing a lot of growth in categories like vitamin supplements and minerals, skincare, health trackers. There's rising gym memberships. I think gym memberships across the country are up like 20% since 2019. This all suggests people's focus on leading healthier lives, which then also permeates into some other categories like CPG, where folks are now looking for minimally processed foods and foods with higher protein and fiber contents. I think that this tacks on well both to our niche manufacturing and enthusiast consumer buckets. Healthier services is another one that we're looking at. So value-based care keeps evolving and morphing in this country, but the focus remains on better standards of care while being most efficient given rising costs in the industry. So solutions that can help providers tend to the patient needs in a more cost-efficient manner, but fully effective way, will, I think, perform very well for the coming years. Another trend we really like is the experience economy. I think that this is also driven by a generational shift where millennials are starting families sort of later on average than preceding generations. So travel, sports, concerts, event attendance all will continue to grow despite disposable income tightness. That's at least the expectation from the research that we've seen. I think that sports and concert tourism, so actually traveling for events, is expected to grow at something like high teens through 2030. And there's actually a survey commissioned that 64% of international travelers will rather cut discretionary spending in other categories in order to be able to afford to continue to travel. The last big one that I see, and there's probably a lot more, but just the ones that we've been, keeping an eye on, is aerospace and defense. I think that the revival of NATO spending is a big lever. I'm also a big believer in strength as a deterrent. And given the, invasion of Ukraine as a cautionary tale, European military spending as a percent of GDP is scheduled to climb. Namely, Germany and Poland, I think, are going to come up to 2% and 4.5%, respectively. So those are, some of the markets and trends that we will keep track of closely in the coming months into 2026.
Yeah, I appreciate you digging into some of those trends. That's always fun for our listeners. So, Monty, you get to wrap us up here. From your point of view, where do you think smart money will focus in 2026?
It's the perfect question. It's right. It's we all need the answer to that. But listen, I once again, I think as an investor, we've got to focus where we historically focus, and that's in services. But then, my breakdown services, there's uncertainty in the economy right now. I think we can all appreciate that uncertainty as to what 2026 will look like. So for us, it's finding those areas where we believe there is stability and recurring demand, and areas that we spend a lot of time in are utility services, infrastructure services, IT services. Those are all areas incremental demand and recurring demand really is quite prevalent. Another area that I think people recognize some of this result of the tariff implications, but I think generally a trend in the U.S. is the reshoring and onshoring, finding the opportunities to invest there and take advantage of increased demand. Nico mentioned data centers. We're trying to figure out where we can participate there. And sometimes it's tangentially. It may not be directly servicing a data center, but servicing a company that is servicing a data center. So these are the areas that I'd say are subsets of areas that were targeted. One thing that I wanted to highlight that we are spending a lot more time thinking about is the implications of AI, how a business or sector can benefit from AI and how it can be surprised by AI. And we're doing what we can to get in front of that with all of our portfolio companies. We're working closely to educate them on how they can utilize and benefit from AI and frankly get in front of their competitors with the utilization of AI, but also trying to look around corners to see how AI can be a negative implication as well for them. So to me, that's the one area that I think most people recognize. There's tremendous uncertainty, and we just have to be very mindful of that and focused on how we can leverage it and not get surprised by it.
Yep, makes a lot of sense. We've tackled AI in other podcasts, and I agree there's a lot of uncertainty, but certainly opportunities. So, unfortunately, gents, that's going to do it for our episode today. Listeners, if you want to hear more from Nico and Monty, remember if you started with part B, go back to part A, which came out a couple of weeks ago. So, again, Monty and Nico, thank you for joining us and sharing your valuable perspectives. Appreciate it.
Had a great time. Thanks, Todd.
Yep.
Nico, great chatting with you.
Same here, Monty. Thanks, Todd, for having us. Really interesting conversation.
To our listeners, thanks so much for tuning in. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and leave a review of the show wherever you get your podcasts.
Until next time, this has been BDO's Private Equity Perspectives.
If you
views presented by our guests do not necessarily reflect the views of their respective firms.